Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
Safe from our hovels.
Long distance podcast.
Here in this time of uncertainty. Long distance podcast. If you notice a strange skip in audio quality, that would be why.
So what's our topic this week?
We're actually going to be talking about a really fine, fabulous, and wonderful cozy mystery novel called Tag for Death, a Sarah Winston mystery.
By Sherry Harris, published 2014 by Kensington Press. Now I know what you're thinking. What's a cozy mystery?
Yeah, I think everyone's thinking that right now.
It's Murder, She Wrote.
There it is. This is Murder, She Wrote. This is an unaired episode of Murder, She Wrote.
Mystery novel featuring an amateur sleuth, not a cop. You have to tell me if you're a cop.
That's the law.
Solving mysteries. Usually murder, but the details are never gory. Because this is cozy mystery.
In which this one's already failed a little bit, but we'll get into that.
And most cozy mysteries are centered around a theme, such as animals, like the Cat Who mystery series by Lillian Jackson Brown, wherein a reporter solves crimes with his two Siamese cats. Ghosts, such as the Aunt Dimity series by Nancy Atherton, wherein a woman is haunted by the ghost of her dead aunt who helps her solve mysteries.
Fuck off, auntie.
Or perhaps even antiques, which is what I was told this particular cozy mystery was themed around.
Vaguely, very, very vaguely. If you have like a loose definition of a theme, like...
We were lied to. Is what I'm saying.
Yeah, we were lied to.
So, okay, the only reason I know this book exists is because I found a pamphlet from Kensington Press outlining all the cozy mystery novels they had to offer. And they had a whole page dedicated to, like, listing all the mysteries out by themes. And under the theme of antiques was this series. So Kensington Press, the publishing company, is spending their marketing budget telling everyone that this is an antiques-themed mystery.
And that is a big, fat lie. It's not.
Let's get into the blurb real quick.
All right, yeah.
I'll just read it off.
Give us some blurb action, please.
Some sick blurb action. Starting your life over at age 38 isn't easy. But that's what Sarah Winston finds herself facing when her husband CJ runs off with a 19-year-old temptress named Tiffany. Sarah's self-prescribed therapy happily involves hitting all the garage and tag sales in and around her small town of Ellington, Massachusetts. If only she could turn her love for bargain hunting into a full-time career. But after returning from a particularly successful day searching for yard sale treasures, Sarah finds a grisly surprise in one of her bags, a freshly bloodied shirt that undoubtedly belongs to her ex, CJ, who now happens to be Ellington's chief of police. If that's not bad enough, it seems Tiffany has gone missing. Now it's up to Sarah to prove that her cold-hearted ex is not a cold-blooded killer. One man's junk is another man's treasure, but finding that treasure can be murder.
Christ.
Okay, so from that blurb, you'd think that this mystery, its premise, its clues, its train of sleuthing, would somehow revolve around these tag sales, perhaps.
I was under the impression originally, yes. I've got to say, she doesn't even get that good a deal.
Please tell us how this book portrays the realities of tag sailing in your experience.
Well, the blurb says like, oh, after a particularly like good haul, like she finds a dish, like a single dish, and she's like, sick dish, and then she collects a bunch of literal trash, and it's like, there it is, the fucking find of the century. Thank you, Ellington, Massachusetts. I don't know. She's just like. It does the crime sin of telling and not showing, where I'm pretty sure I remember that there's a scene where she just takes her friend yard sailing, and then she's just like, all right, now, what's important is that you don't look excited, but she's saying this, like, in front of everyone at the tag sale, like, out loud, and then her friend is like, oh, I found something, I'm excited, and she's just like, don't be excited, and then turns to the seller and is like, $2, please. It's the way I imagine a serial killer has imagined tag sailing.
There is a lot wrong with the main character's ethics, but
there's a lot wrong with the main character.
Okay, so that scene for me struck close to home because you did the exact same thing to me when I went text healing with you.
Because you have a miserable poker face.
Because I can't lie for shit. So when I find something I'm excited to find, I'm very evidently excited about it. And I also can't pick up on hints or cues or like read a room in any way, shape, or form. So when you said you didn't want something, I said I would take it because I was interested. Not realizing you were pretending to be uninterested so you'd pay less money for it.
You know.
Was that the carriage whip?
Yeah, that was the carriage whip.
I got it for $1, so it worked out.
Or, I don't know if it was the carriage whip, but it was something on that trip, yeah.
So that's the thing, like, you say this book tells and doesn't show, and I say, sometimes people need to be told, and sometimes those people are me.
I guess, but I don't know, it's done in such an awkward, stilted way.
I will say you were much cooler about it than the characters in this book.
Well, that's the...
You waited until we got to the car before you told me, hey, my dude.
Well, yeah.
Remember lying?
That's the thing. She just gives her, like, a full dressing down in public. Like, it's like, really? I don't know. The main character just doesn't behave like a human.
Okay. I want to try to avoid spoilers for at least, like, the first half of the episode, and then we can go full spoiler.
Okay.
But, focusing on the antiques and not the other crime sins of this book. I was heartened at the beginning where she manages to pick up an antique table that's broken for $100.
Yeah.
And then she repairs it with carpenter's glue and bungee cords.
Yeah, that, okay, all right. I'm glad you brought it up because I was incensed.
Okay, so that, all right. D, with your 14 years of experience in the antiques industry, is that how you would repair a table?
Fuck no, it's so goddamn weird. It's so goddamn weird on, so like, bit by bit, it's like, so she looks at the table and she's like, if this table weren't broken, it would be worth $800. And then after that, her internal monologue says, well, I want to get a better price. Then I think it was listed for $300. And then she's like, I can't lowball them too hard or they'll be insulted and won't entertain my offers. And then she just goes, I'll give you $50. So like, I don't think she's going to grasp on how like American money works.
Which is insane to me because when I was working at the antique shop, I was told to never offer or accept anything below 50% of the asking price.
Yeah, it's wild to me that the narrator goes, if I lowball, they will be angry, and then immediately lowballs like worse than I've ever heard in my life. And then it works.
Yeah, I can guarantee if I was at the shop and a customer came up with a $300 table and said $50, I had carte blanche as an employee to tell them to get out.
Oh yeah, 100%. You could just be like, okay, fuck off, sir.
Okay, bye.
All right, that was a funny joke, but now you have to go. You have to go back to clown school. I hear you're delinquent. So she does that, and then so she's like, yeah, she gets it for $100 by browbeating the seller and also taking advantage of the fact that she's exhausted, which she says out loud is what she's doing.
Yes.
And,
she says, I noticed that this person was exhausted and overwhelmed, so I knew I could get a good price, which is so, a little sociopath, but sure.
So fucking creepy. So then she's just like, yeah, if this table were new, it would be worth, like, a mint, like $800 to $1,000. And then she takes it home and, it literally, I have the note here, literally slathers it with carpenter glue and then puts some books and bungee cords on it. And she's like, good as new. Perfect. Like, just the idea that you would take a high-end estate piece and the book, as it says, slather it with carpenter glue and just kind of, like, slam it back together. That's nuts. That's beyond fucking insane. And just the cognitive dissonance of someone knowing that that's what it's worth. And then, like, from that, I have to extrapolate that they know how to fix it properly and they're ignoring it.
So, as an overall representation of tag sailing in antiques, do you feel this book was accurate or in any way representative of the industry?
That's a tough one. Yes, I'm actually going to go ahead with an overall yes. It's,
Ooh.
Well, yeah, I mean, like you said, that whole, like, oh, you can't be too excited. When she mentions being pissed off about the lady who came with a $100 bill in the hopes that, like, people would just be like, oh, whatever, just take it. I have change for that. Like, that kind of thing, that sort of grift is all pretty accurate. Okay, the major inaccuracy, biggest inaccuracy. When she prices things, it always seems to be weirdly optimistically higher than the person selling it was thinking, which never happens. That is just not how that works.
If anything, people tend to overvalue their personal treasures.
Yeah, I think there's one line where she's, like, organizing a sale and some kids are like, my toys are worth millions, and she has to convince them that they're not. And, okay, if it was that scene, but with every single person she interacted with, then it would be accurate. Because, like, I'm pretty sure there, so she, like, is it a spoiler that she organizes yard sales?
No, that's not a spoiler.
Because there's one where she organizes it for a lady, and again with the cognitive dissonance, the lady is just like, oh, this vase was from Louisa May Alcott, and like, that's a wild statement on a couple fronts, but so she knows, like, oh, this vase was from Louisa May Alcott, my personal best friend, but then she's like, I don't know what any of this is, I don't know what any of this stuff in my basement is, what am I looking at, I don't know what lamps are.
Yeah, she has a washstand from Louisa May Alcott's estate with a letter from Louisa May Alcott's father about gifting this washstand to a servant in lieu of payment.
Which doesn't happen. Just for the, like, that also is like an incredible...
Dee, is that not provenance?
I mean, provenance exists, but it's usually, you only ever see, like, letters of provenance when it's someone who's already, like, valuable and worth something.
To be fair, Bronson Alcott definitely believed that he himself was worth something.
He definitely did, and I guess, you know, like, knowing the man, maybe it's more likely at that point. But it's just like, it would be strange if I found a letter that says, I am giving you this vase so that I don't have to pay you, my servant. Which is like, alright, that's a strange thing to do, I guess, Mr. Bronson, but...
But you're right in that, like, this woman has that level of antiques all throughout her house, but then also attempts to throw away a box of tintypes that I guess she just doesn't care about.
Yeah, she has like a weirdly encyclopedic knowledge about some things where, like, apropos of nothing, she launches into a description of how to load a musket and like how smoothbore rifles work and stuff. But then she's like, she has a box of like daguerreotypes and she's just like, I don't know what these are. They're like weird hard photographs. I'm gonna throw them out.
She tries to throw away tintypes, which is, if you listen to our photography episodes, insane.
Yeah, it's just, it's nuts on a lot of levels. It's also implied that the tintypes are her personal family photos, which adds a layer of bonkers to it to me. But she's like, I have these precious family artifacts. My husband says to get rid of them. I'd throw them in the garbage. Now back to my encyclopedic knowledge of smoothbore rifles.
There is also a scene about haggling at a flea market over a statue, wherein the sellers are a pair of sisters, one of whom strongly believes the statue is cursed, and the other one is just trying to sell the statue.
Yeah, okay.
That one felt ripped from life to me.
Okay, I guess it did, but, like, the thing is, like, here, on either of the coasts, I guarantee having, like, the story that those women had would have upped the price pretty considerably. You know, like if you're shopping in California, like, near San Francisco, I guarantee that someone would be like, this statue is worth $400 more than you're willing to pay because it's cursed. What I'm selling you is a rare opportunity to experience a curse.
Again, with our Haunted Antiques episode, we discovered that people are just as disappointed when objects aren't haunted as when they are.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I actually have trouble imagining a scenario where someone basically gives something away because it's haunted. Because I have only experienced the opposite. But that's just me. I don't know, maybe some of you have run into some haunted objects. It's probably not a wheelchair. Those aren't, like, ever haunted. Okay, I think it's absolute horseshit that her husband's just like, but the statue because it's pretty, and it turns out to be like an original bronze Erte.
I don't know what a bronze Erte is.
Erte was a 1930s illustrator.
Like, on a scale of 1 to J.C. Leyendecker.
J.C. Leyendecker fully.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, like, he's very well known. He did a pretty limited number of sculptures. And it's a high fantasy that you would go to a tag sale and run into, like, twin sisters who insist it's cursed and want you to take it off their hands. Because, like, I think the base price for an Erte sculpture is something like $3,000.
Whoopsies.
I don't know why, but that, like, rankled at me. And because her reaction is so undersized to the... Like, if my husband spent $200 on a fucking original bronze Erte, Actually, no, let me flip that. If I was the husband who did that, and my wife was like, oh, this is an original bronze air tank, good job, very casually. Like, I'd be like, give me more credit. What is wrong with you?
If I can be coy about it, the plot kind of hinges about their marriage not working out.
Yeah, but it definitely hinges in, like, it's not working out because he was mean to her. It's just like, I don't know, she really didn't. She had such a, like, I'm going, all right, my theory is, before we get into spoilers, my running theory is that she's a fucking psychopath. Because she has such a shallow reaction to finding, like, a genuine rare work of art.
She also very clearly doesn't understand how human conversations and or friendships work.
No,
but
no.
We'll get into that.
She has her morals, her relationships, all of them point to my pet theory that she's a fucking psychopath.
But yeah, so from the discussion thus far, you might get the idea that this book does actually contain antiques.
No, that's us hyper-focusing.
We have just told you all of the antiques that are in this book.
Yep, that's it. Sorry.
We've done it. We've saved you 8 hours.
I actually think we covered at least one thing that wasn't an antique. So we've already done more work than the author did in inserting antiques.
For a book that is marketed as an antiques cozy mystery, I would say it's about 5 to 8% antiques.
That's really generous. I'd give it 3 to 4.
It is about 80% Air Force, 10% rampant sociopathy, and... All right, and now to discuss the non-antiques portion of the book, we enter Spoiler Zone. Welcome to Spoiler.
Wow, wow, you're entering the Spoiler Zone.
So this book should really be marketed as a military mystery.
It's absolutely 100% a military mystery.
Because the plot revolves around an Air Force base, all of the suspects, the motivation for the crime, all the clues that lead to the discovery of the crime. Except none of the clues actually lead to the discovery of the crime.
Yeah, no, classic.
What happens is she spends a lot of time faffing about, committing, like, breaking and entering and trespassing over and over again in not only private residences, but also on an army base.
I was gonna say, she commits some high federal... What she does is technically treason, I think.
She does actually commit treason, which is, you know, an issue for most people, I find, but...
I think she's literally a terrorist.
She is kind of a domestic terrorist, but it's okay, because... because 20 pages before the end of the book, it occurs to her to perform a cursory Google search about the murder victim, which instantly leads her to the real killer.
And interestingly enough, she didn't think to do that before committing what I think is 3 separate incidents of domestic terrorism.
So she straight up breaks into a couple of houses to search for, and I use air quotes liberally here, clues. She also pretends to be from the VFW to illegally obtain entrance to another woman's home and get her personal property, because she says, oh, I'm the person you call to take donations for the VFW after your tag sale. Just give all the bags to me. No, I don't have any of the paperwork you would expect. Goodbye.
She justifies it by saying, well, I did volunteer with them once, so this is okay.
Just her sheer sociopathy as she...
Wait, are you really gonna leave out how she impersonated a teenager and snuck onto a children's bus?
She also impersonates a teenager and sneaks onto a school bus in order to illegally get onto an Air Force base that she has been banned from because they're sick of her breaking and entering. And then when a member of the guard at the Air Force base says, hey, you're not supposed to be here, you've been banned... Tell us how you got on here, because being able to sneak onto an Air Force base successfully when you've been banned is like a huge national security risk. She says, oh, I'll tell you later when I'm done doing what I'm doing.
Not just
and then never tells
not them. Just a national security risk, an active, like, domestic threat, because someone got murdered on base.
Two people got murdered on base.
Two people get murdered on base, and she's like, well, no, technically only one, but... Well, they think that two people got murdered on base. And then, so they're like, hey, how you got on? That might explain how those murders happened. And she's like, fuck off. And then she just runs off to go do more crimes, basically. I like, there's that cop character you're obviously supposed to dislike, except that he's, like, the only character that has his head screwed on right. Like, she's acting intensely suspicious.
The one who's like, hey, this woman keeps breaking and entering and lying all over the place. I think I'm gonna keep tabs on her in this active murder investigation.
This woman is literally stalking my family. I must be the bad guy.
She stalks his family and then is surprised when he says, stay away from my family.
He like yells at her. He's like, don't go anywhere near my family again, you fucking weirdo. And she's just like, this is unfair. This is police corruption. It's something.
So, okay, quick plot summary before we confuse everyone.
Oh, yeah.
Our protagonist, she was married to an officer in the Air Force. He cheated on her, she divorced him, and now he is a police chief in the small town that she's settled in. She goes tag sailing, as mentioned in the blurb, returns from collecting donated goods after tag sales to find that her car has an extra garbage bag in it, and in that garbage bag is her ex-husband's uniform with blood all over it. And the girl that he cheated on her with, Tiffany, is missing. So her first instinct is, I'd better go tell my ex-husband so we can both hide this from the rest of the cops.
And, they don't tell anybody ever, by the way.
They don't tell anyone that this evidence was planted in her car. And the entire book, she is, I would say, irrationally convinced from the beginning that her ex-husband could not have possibly committed the murder, which, again, is ultimately right, but I would argue that is more in favor of the author's last-minute ass pull rather than any evidence presented through the book.
Yes, he's obviously very suspicious. What I was really surprised about was that nobody ever seems to consider her a suspect. And, like, that's not even just the shirt thing, because I know the shirt, like, yeah, the big thing is that, like, oh, they keep the shirts a secret because he doesn't want her to get in trouble. But that's, like, far from the only thing she does that made me look at her and go, Jesus, if I were a cop, you'd be my number one suspect. And they brush by it. Like, some characters mention, like, yeah, you would be a good suspect, but we don't suspect you. And it's like, what are you fucking talking about? She finds both bodies. The murder weapon belongs to her, and the first thing she says when they find it is, hey, that's mine!
So, okay, the first body they find is a skeleton that's had its skull smashed in by what they later discover is the flea market statue mentioned earlier that the cop ex-husband had bought for our protagonist on their honeymoon that had somehow, again, fallen into the possession of Tiffany, the other woman, which, again, is wild because, like you said, it's like a $3,000 statue that they got for a couple hundred.
Does it even really cover how she gets it?
Our protagonist doesn't notice it's missing from her possession until it's been used in a murder.
Yeah, they like hand wave it, which is like, oh god, the divorce. Like, you best believe it, during the divorce, my first thought is like, I'm taking the fucking $4,000 statue. Like, it's not the kind of thing you forget about. Then again, I don't know, maybe she carpenter glued it to something.
So, the second body is another young female airman on the base who they find not skeletonized, but extremely dead in the back room of a thrift store that our protagonist volunteers at.
Yeah, that was the part where I was really surprised because it was way gorier than I've come to expect from Cozy Mysteries.
That's the other thing. Cozy Mysteries aren't supposed to be gory, and yet here we have our graphic descriptions of skulls bashed in and blood everywhere, and the protagonist keeps flashing back to finding bodies.
Yeah, it's grim. It's way grim. Not that it really, at the end of the day, bothers the protagonist much. She, like, it's really easy to distract her with a tag sale.
Real talk? Completely forgot the inciting action of this entire book. She keeps getting phone calls where someone just calls her, fires a gun, and hangs up.
That never comes up! It doesn't go anywhere!
It goes nowhere, and it means nothing. Technically, the villain was doing it the entire time, but you could remove that element entirely and still have the entire book proceed. You could also remove tag sales as a concept entirely and still the book proceed. Just have her be moving boxes from her move out after the divorce and, oh, surprise, bloody shirt.
I can't understand, believe, fathom, or grasp the insanity of a plot that involves a character getting gunshot calls every morning, and at no point does she herself link it up to the two murders she discovered. Like, nobody ever says, hey, the constant threatening gun calls, do you think those are related to the murders that you've been inexplicably extricated in? Like, no one says it. It just, she gets them and she's like, ugh, this again. I gotta go catch the murderer. It's really fucking weird.
Speaking of subplots that go fucking nowhere, she also has a consensual, reciprocal, good time, one night stand with a man who is not only very kind towards her and genuinely attracted to her and wants to be with her for more than a one night stand, he's also a crazy rich, sexy bachelor in universe considered the most eligible bachelor in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And her reaction to finding herself in the situation is, oh, I can't believe I'm such a tramp. What a slut I am. How could I possibly? And I'm just like, ma'am, you were already divorced?
She's like, I betrayed my husband. But like, it was post-divorce. She had a good time. The guy was respectful and nice.
Not only the character herself, but the narrative as a whole treats her like this wretched piece of used garbage for going to a bar at night and having a good time.
A good time with a nice person, yeah.
And she's just like, if anyone finds out about this, I'm ruined. It's just like, if anyone finds out you went on a date after you were divorced, what is the problem?
it's fucked up. So one thing, it got like really disturbing because at that point I was just like, all right, the author has some fucking problems. And then my brain did a cartoon tire screech noise, and I realized that, like, both of the murdered women were described, like, multiple times as being promiscuous. And, like, I can't help but think, like, there's some subconscious shit going on there where it's just like, and this girl died because she dated a lot, and this girl also died, and she was just, like, she was both frigid and a whore, and it was just like, holy shit. It's like a lot of psychic garbage.
This is, if this wasn't already Air Force the novel, it would be slut-shaming the novel, but...
Yeah, slut-shaming on base, my new title. It's okay these women are dead because they're whores.
The first murdered woman is a Latina named Tiffany Lopez, who is, in-universe, a 19-year-old husband-stealing whore... described as having Jennifer Lopez's curves.
The funniest fucking and thing.
And her personal goal in life, her reason to get into the Air Force was to marry an officer. She's not there to serve America. She's not there to protect her country. She's not there to work together for a brighter tomorrow. She is there to get her man. And she's not afraid to steal someone else's husband to do it. And it was at that point I realized, oh, this is a book by middle-aged conservative white women for middle-aged conservative white women.
I think the wildest thing is, like, that there were only, apparently, according to Miss Tiffany, cleverly named Lopez, there were only two colonels on base somehow, and both of them were married.
So she had to fuck both of them.
Like, there was really no unmarried colonels?
Which is to say nothing of the very nice Italian couple that attempt against all odds to befriend our protagonist, despite the fact that our protagonist is clearly a sociopath who is both uninterested and incapable of reciprocating their friendship. But they try. This couple, they are so Italian, and you can tell because she basically just did a gender swap of the restaurant from Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah, yeah.
And not only that, but later in the book, it's revealed that the husband explicitly has mob ties through his cousin.
That was fucked up. Listen, like...
Which is like, okay, wait, cool, awesome. Now we're being racist against other white people. We've reached that level, which again, is peak New England. So I guess props for accurate representation of Massachusetts culture.
It's also just, like, a very clear sign that this woman visited Massachusetts, but, like, was not from there. Because it's just, like, it's just not the kind of thing you say around here.
It is very much the Connecticut tourist approach to Massachusetts.
It's like, you know, when you say that, there's a good chance you're talking to someone who had a relative killed by the mob. And so we don't say it. We don't, like, do it very much, is the thing.
The Italian couple owns an Italian restaurant. And has mob ties. And it's just...
Oh, and the Italian restaurant has been visited by no fewer than Ted Kennedy and Guy Fieri. It, the novel not name drops Guy Fieri by name. I was delighted.
So, to recap, the Latina is a husband-stealing whore. The Italian couple own a restaurant and have mob ties. And the singing teacher who lives next door to our protagonist is an opera singer who's overcome drug addiction. And no sooner does, very late in the novel, our protagonist learn that this woman used to be an addict, she immediately assumes, oh, she's not actually giving singing lessons. She's dealing drugs to the teenagers she's giving singing lessons to.
Yeah, yeah.
Immediately comes to that conclusion, ends the book without once trying to re-examine her prejudices on that front. But...
So, wait, all right. I know we're like, bicycling all over the page, but one thing that really, really fucking bothered me, I just reread the end to make sure that I wasn't, like, hallucinating. There's a sub-sub-sub-plot about another military wife cheating on her husband, and, like, it wraps up that she was cheating on her husband with the murderer, and also she's been dealing drugs. Do they ever, like, talk about that?
Oh, yeah, speaking of sociopathy, our protagonist discovers all of this and, again, tells no one.
Nobody, not a god, but, like...
Because it's not relevant to her ex-husband getting released from prison.
Does the narrative ever, like, acknowledge that, like...
She never tells anyone that Dina cheated on her husband with a murderer. Or that she's dealing drugs.
To children.
To children.
It's explicitly to children.
She also, at the end of the novel, the big twist is that her ex-husband never actually slept with Tiffany. That was a lie Tiffany made up to try and get him to marry her.
Which is great.
She got the man drunk, then crawled into bed with him after he passed out, took off all of her clothes, and then when he woke up, claimed that they'd had sex.
I'm gonna call that, by the way, sexual assault.
Yeah, you know, I feel like that counts. So Tiffany confesses all of this to our protagonist.
In the back of an ambulance.
Once it's discovered that, by the way, Tiffany isn't dead, if you haven't already figured that out. The whole thing was a setup.
Yeah, she gone-girled it.
She sexually assaulted a man, and then when he didn't marry her, she tried to frame him for her own murder, Gone Girl style. So the protagonist discovers all this. She's like, oh, he didn't cheat on me after all. And her immediate thoughts are, should I tell my husband about any of this? No.
No.
I should never tell him.
I will never tell him.
I should also never tell him about that awesome date I had one night in Lowell that I'm somehow ashamed of. Despite the fact that it occurred well after our divorce, after we'd both thought he had cheated on me.
I want him to live with the same illogical guilt that I do for the rest of his natural fucking life.
I will not only keep my own sexual history a secret from him forevermore, even as the book ends with us getting back together, but I will also not tell him that he's been lied to this whole time and that he never actually cheated on me.
Exactly. What a hell. I like the one. There's a moment where it almost feels like the author became self-aware for a second, where, like, I'm pretty sure the protagonist, whose name I don't know, by the way. So good book, basically. She thinks to herself, man, if I left him without even, like, asking him what happened, how good was our marriage, really? And then they immediately just, like, ah, we're getting back together. It's fine.
It's at the same time shaming the protagonist for not acting on information she didn't have, but also justifying her continued concealment of this information.
Yeah, not acting on information neither of them had. She's a demon, a snake of some sort, I think.
There are repeated scenes where she attempts to, like, subtly get clues from people by talking to them, and then is surprised when they also ask her questions, because she doesn't understand how human conversation works.
And it talks about how she's annoyed sometimes when they talk about things that aren't specifically what she wants to be hearing. Like, they're just like, yeah, I had a rough day, and her internal monologue will be like, I don't fucking care about that, I came to you for information! Why are you talking to me about this dumb horseshit?
And all of these people are operating under the illusion that she is their friend.
All of them.
There's so many people in this book who honestly seem way cooler to hang out with than she is.
Yeah.
But all these people who repeatedly try to reach out to her and befriend her and spend time with her because they know she's going through a rough time after her divorce from her husband that she thinks has cheated on her. Her landlord, the opera singer, reaches out to her to befriend her. Her next door neighbor repeatedly reaches out. Her friend in town who owns a painting store that, again, goes nowhere, but still continually tries to reach out and be there for her. And the very lovely couple who own the Italian restaurant repeatedly not only give her free food, but also spend time with her and want to make sure she's okay and looked after.
Yeah, and she's annoyed with all of them for not giving her information.
It's bonkers for yonkers. Here's the thing. I genuinely enjoy antiques. I genuinely enjoy cozy mysteries. And this book was neither.
It wasn't anything.
This book was an Air Force thriller that I think got rebranded at the last minute. And Kensington is doing it a huge disservice by marketing it as an antiques cozy mystery.
This is a quick sidebar. Does she eat anything that isn't baked ziti and fluffernutters?
She also eats a lot of other Italian food from the restaurant.
I was like losing my fucking mind because as far as I could tell, this woman like lived on a diet strictly of like pasta and fluffernutter sandwiches. The fluffernutter only being brought up because it's like a uniquely Massachusetts thing, I guess.
It was invented here.
Yes, but you'd only have to mention it one time.
I cannot judge her dietary decisions because I did spend an entire year in college living off a garbage bag full of stale bagels that my roommate brought home from her job at Dunkin' Donuts.
But the protagonist, again, whose name I really do not know, she is not in college. She's a grown adult woman. Who can't wrap her head around the idea of getting a fucking job. That also is, like, very infuriating.
Well, as she points out, the alimony she gets from her Air Force veteran husband turned police chief is more than sufficient for her to live on. The only reason she needs a job is to keep herself busy. Several other people have to tell her throughout the novel that, hey, do you remember that you like tag sales? Do that.
Yeah, they like, there's in another like fit of sociopathy, she gets like mad at her friend for hooking her up with a job.
A job organizing a tag sale for a woman with too many antiques on her hands because she's so good at tag sailing that she knows how to stage them, she knows how to price them, she knows how to haggle with them, she knows how to stock them, she knows how to set them up, how to break them down, what to do with everything after it's over. She knows tag sales inside and out and somehow throughout the book retains absolutely no interest in tag sales. And also, again, I cannot stress this enough, this entire book could easily happen without a single tag sale.
She has to be forced to engage with tag sales on multiple occasions.
Because she's busy investigating a serial killer on an Air Force base. I swear to God, this book was originally a thriller. I swear to God.
A serial killer I'm still not convinced wasn't her. Like, I know that they unveiled the actual killer who was not a character at all that was introduced very much. So, cool. I'm pretty sure it was her still. I still think she did it.
Okay.
She was the only one who hated those women enough.
We're coming up on an hour of yelling about this book that no one has read.
Okay, wait, can I read you some of my favorite juicy tidbits that don't fit anywhere else?
Please do.
Massachusetts was one of the most patriotic places I'd ever lived.
Okay, so that stuck out to you too, right?
That's horse shit. That's pure horse shit. Pure, absolute, like, undiluted, uncut horseshit.
I will say, we are extremely into the Revolutionary War, for obvious reasons.
That is not the same thing as being patriotic.
I would argue it is patriotic after its own fashion. I would say our veneration of the revolutionary heroes in our state is patriotic.
Yeah, I guess, sure. Here's my favorite sentence possibly in the whole book. The stain looked and smelled exactly like what it was. what a painting with words.
Shaped like itself.
The joggers had reappeared. From the ether, I imagine. There's an entire paragraph where she makes fun of the way people in Massachusetts pronounce things.
Oh yeah, the Massachusetts accent comes up again and again and again, which is, one, fun because you'll note neither podcast host from Massachusetts has one. But,
we don't all have it, yeah. Something about the redundancy where it's absolutely, I'll grab my pocketbook from my rum. Stella pronounced the word room as rum, a peculiarity of speech in this area. Like, I was there.
I've never heard anyone pronounce the word room as rum.
I've never heard that in my life.
Never in my goddamn life. Not even on New Yankee Workshop, not even on this old house. Like, it never happens.
The Coup de Grâce, which this one stunned me because, like you said, this was basically an Air Force thriller. And man, what a branch of the military to write a thriller about, by the way.
Wow! You know my fucking dad was in the Air Force, you asshole!
Listen, Massachusetts is the most patriotic state I've ever been to. my favorite, like, so considering that that is the, like, obviously her passion lies in talking about military protocol, she says, I'd learned that watching Oprah. Nothing good ever happens at a second location. She had to watch Oprah to figure that out when her husband was the chief of police and had apparently taught her nothing about personal safety and crime.
There's also that. I wondered how much of that was actually common sense and how much of that was me mainlining true crime like it was my job. But like, yeah, never a second location is basic shit, especially when your ex-husband is chief of police and previously worked on an Air Force base that you also lived on.
It's, she spends so much time crowing about the fact that, like, her identity's tied in with being a military wife that, like, immediately stating that she knew this because she watched Oprah is really wild to me.
Like, her whole life is the military, but she also has such obvious disdain for the female airmen.
All of them. Yeah, she hates them.
She hates all of them. They're all vapid whores out to get her husband. And none of them are capable of lifting a finger without breaking a nail. And okay, so at the end of the novel, when Tiffany was alive the whole time, surprise, they are both kidnapped by the actual murderer. And Tiffany, who again, I'm assuming had to get through some kind of basic training to even get into the Air Force? Yeah?
Extensive basic training, yeah.
Right. Okay. She is completely incapable of defending herself in any way. All she can do is like curl up on the floor and whimper. While meanwhile, the military wife is somehow the action star badass. And it's just like, okay, how did Tiffany get into the Air Force?
One answer, Air Force.
I know people make cracks about the Air Force all the time as being like on par with the Coast Guard in terms of military prowess, but like, one, Coast Guard's badass, shut up.
Actually, I think the Coast Guard does more.
I'm serious, but like, you have to actually exert yourself to become a soldier.
Yeah, hey, what are you talking? I love the Coast Guard. Yeah, I mean, all jokes aside, yeah, the Air Force are soldiers. You learn soldier stuff being a soldier. Why was Tiffany so helpless?
You have to be able to throw a punch. You have to be able to jog at least 10 feet. Like, you have to...
I like, and so the murderer is actually just some yokel piece of shit.
Yeah, this book also has a real problem with people from West Virginia, which, she's just, this woman hates everyone who isn't an upper middle class middle-aged white woman.
Ideally married to a colonel.
Yes.
Despite her disdain for women trying to marry colonels. I was just, okay, so at any point does this explain how the recent transplant from West Virginia is suddenly, like, an expert at loading a Revolutionary era war musket? Or where he got
it? The author's presentation of the fictional town of Ellington is such that you cannot go 10 feet without the residents explaining musket loading to you.
Yeah, but it also covers that he only showed up, like, a couple months ago. Like...
yeah, and as soon as he moved in, someone knocked on his door and says... here, this is how you load a Revolutionary era musket. Okay, bye. Don't forget to forget the letter R.
Get really, really good at it. I'll see you in my room. it's just like, how did he come by the gun? And why did any of this happen? Basically. And why would you set up a mystery where none of the clues let me know where you're going?
Why would you set up an entire mystery novel that you claim is about tag sales, but actually resolves when, again, exactly 20 pages from the end of the book, it occurs to the main character, independent of anything happening around her, to do a cursory Google search.
Doesn't, that should have been step one. But, like, here's the thing, if you do a cursory Google search, Ken, you can't commit multiple acts of domestic terrorism.
This is true. This is true. If you do Google searches, you can't commit treason.
God.
She straight up, she's so focused on being a military wife and then just like instant treason.
Yeah, she just, and she violates every fucking rule, moral, like value.
Oh my god.
It was a trip and I loved every minute.
Oh shit, D, we forgot the fucking discussion questions.
Oh god, how could we fucking forget?
Okay, back up. So,
wow, we're back up.
Lest you think we are reading too much into this book, On the author's website, she has posted discussion questions for this book.
So good. Literally so good.
Question one. When Sarah gets divorced and has to move off base, she feels she has been exiled. She's a stranger finding her way in a strange new land. Some readers find it hard to believe that Sarah stays in Ellington, where she has no family or professional ties. Can a place you come to after childhood just feel like home? Have you ever experienced this? Why do you think she stays?
I mean, she's... All right. First problem with this discussion question. It's laid out pretty clearly in the book why she stays.
And what is that reason?
It's because she likes it. She's just like, oh, this is a good town and I enjoy it. And like...
But why? Why, Dee? Why?
Because it's old and she likes old things. Maybe.
Does she? I think she just likes committing treason.
She likes coach purses. Yeah, maybe. she stays in Ellington because it's got an Air Force base with surprisingly lax security. And she knows if she goes anywhere else, that will not be the case.
Question two. Despite CJ's infidelity and the divorce, Sarah tries to protect CJ from becoming a murder suspect by hiding the evidence. Why do you think she did that? Would you do the same for your husband, for an ex?
So that's, oh, all right, that's...
Would you also commit treason to protect your man?
So, like, all right, like, knowing the details of the treason aside, that's the part that makes me think that the author might also be fucking, like, a sociopath. Because multiple times in the book and also in these discussion questions, it, like, exercises this really, like, why would you do something for someone that didn't benefit you? Like, what are you talking... If I, like, yeah, if he's your... Like, what do you... If he's your ex-husband and you know he's innocent and you can prove he's innocent, why would... You're just, like, actually asking, like, why wouldn't you just let him suffer and rot? Because he wronged you. Like, hey, you're a broken person. No one thinks like this.
See, I came at that from the completely opposite angle because she has no way of knowing that he's innocent. There is nothing in the book indicating that he is innocent.
I'm rolling with the narrative that, like, if we take on the mindset of the protagonist, we are certain that he is innocent. The question is framed in such a fashion where it's like, would you do something to help someone even if you weren't, like, their biggest fan? And it's like, hey, do you need help? Do you need, like, a book? I think Dr. Seuss is a great one.
I was coming at this from the angle of, like, wife of Dennis Rader, wife of the Green River Killer, like, wife of John Wayne Gacy. Like, yes.
That's not the same. That's not the same at all.
If any of these women had discovered evidence of the murders in their house, they should have gone to the police. Because that is the correct thing to do. When you find out your husband has killed people, you go to the police and you say, hey, please stop my husband from murdering other people.
Yeah, practically speaking, that is the case, but, like, I feel like the question's talking more about, like, why would you want to protect him? And it's just like, because I'm a human, you fucking lizard. It's just like, yeah, like, of course she wants to protect him, because she's not a fucking lizard person. She's not a scorpion human that doesn't know what empathy looks like. Like, what are you talking about?
Okay, but, like, if my spouse had, like, come home covered in blood, and also two young women were dead... And also, their blood was all over his clothes.
But yeah, okay, but under... Well, here's the thing. Under the specific circumstances of the book, she really should have turned herself in.
Under the specific circumstances of the book, she should have, one, turned over the evidence to the police.
And said, oh, I probably did this. Because it's me. Because I am the most guilty-looking party.
Question three. Sarah has a one-night stand and tagged for death. It's so out of character, she can't forgive herself. Do you forgive her? Should she forgive herself?
That's such a fucking wild question. That's such a wild... Do you forgive her?
Yes.
Imagine just grilling your audience about whether or not they approved morally of the...
I forgive her for going on a date after she was divorced and having a nice time with a guy who was kind to her and to whom she was genuinely attracted.
I don't... That... It's so fucking weird. It's so weird. This woman, like, really has hang-ups. Like, serious hang-ups.
I think this woman heard about Tinder, did no further research, assumed this was what it was like, and immediately disapproved.
Or, like, her like, friend went on Tinder and got, like, a raunchy message, and she was just like, horrible, 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 horrible. Sex is bad. Unless it's with the Colonel.
But again, our protagonist doesn't even get a raunchy message. She has a perfectly nice time with a man who is genuinely a gentleman about it.
Yeah, she has a consensual fun time with a nice person who calls her back.
What the fuck? The way that this is foreshadowed and built up to in the novel, I thought she had been, like, gang raped in an alley. Like, that was the level of, like, horror shame attached to this incident. And then I read through the whole thing, and I'm like, so she wasn't date raped. Like, nothing happened. She consensually had a great time with this guy who was very kind to her.
I thought she had gone on, like, a drug-fueled bender. Like, she'd, like, slept with, like, 8 strangers in a weekend. She didn't know any of their names or faces. Like, she got mildly addicted to fentanyl. Like, like you said, the buildup was so dark. And then it was just, like, she went on a date. She had a good time.
She immediately regrets it. She's like, oh my god, what have I done? I'm just like, you met a guy at a bar and that's it. That's not, what? Where is the crime sin?
She doesn't immediately regret it. She goes home and thinks about it and mulls it over, and then she regrets it. In the immediate, she's like, ah, fun time. And then she goes home and she's like, I am the power of Babylon. Strike me where I stand. It's really...
Jesus. Question 4. Do you think CJ has any chance of winning Sarah back? Is infidelity ever forgivable?
That's a wild question, given that you wrote the book and you know how it ends.
Well, it's also like, presumably these discussion questions are being read by people after they finish the book, at which point you know that CJ never actually committed infidelity. It was all a lie based on him getting sexually assaulted while he was drunk.
Yeah, like, that's, okay, so that's, like, more evidence on the pile that there's something wrong, that the author might actually be, like, a transmuted, like, bat of some sort. Like, that they're just like, could you ever forgive your husband for being tricked, assaulted, and lied to? Like, I don't know, I would hope that I could forgive him for that.
Yeah. I would hope that I could forgive my husband for being a sexual assault survivor. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I would really, like, here's the thing. Yeah, yes, and then yes again. Like, of course he can win her back. He didn't do anything wrong.
Question number 5. Sarah gave up on her marriage very quickly. If Sarah were your best friend, what would you tell her to do? So, okay, 1. I feel like it's extremely judgmental to say she gave up on it very quickly because... to the best of her knowledge and to the best of her husband's knowledge, he had slept with another woman while they were married.
Yeah, it's, I guess a quick egress is actually what I would recommend at that point.
Yeah, like if a friend came up to me and said, I just found out my husband cheated on me, I would say, leave him.
With an inferior, like it wasn't even just like, oh, as far as I know, my husband cheated on me with like essentially a child, like.
Okay, yeah, so yeah, he is an officer on an Air Force base who, to the best of everyone's knowledge, has committed adultery with one of the people he is supposed to be overseeing. Like, one of the people he holds rank over.
One of the people he refers to as his kids. So that was, like, that was creepy and weird.
Not only is it insubordination, but, like...
yeah, it's just gross.
It's fucked up. It's fucked up on every level. Until we find out it never actually happened. At which point, we kind of question why the novel happened.
I questioned that the whole time. The real mystery. So the secondary mystery is, why was this written?
Question 6. Are you team CJ or team Seth? Why?
Team Seth.
Seth. Okay. Seth is the eligible bachelor who has a very nice consensual time and is very kindly and gentlemanly towards her the entire time and afterward.
I say team Seth, not because, like, obviously CJ is actually a tragic figure in this. And, like, that's not his fault. But, like, I'm team Seth because he's the only one that, like, gets described as having any chemistry with her. She seems to genuinely like him. I don't know.
I am team CJ and Seth having a chance meeting, realizing they have a lot in common in terms of getting absolutely played by the sociopath of a woman and finding happiness in each other's arms.
Yeah, you know what?
Like, that's the team I'm on. Because both of these men deserve better, and frankly, they deserve each other.
Hey, this is gonna be the only fan fiction that this book ever gets.
So those are discussion questions. Now, D, if I have not totally betrayed your trust by demanding you read this book with me.
Okay.
I do have some other antiques-themed books we could try.
I would love to. I would 100. After this one, I'm ready for anything. And in fact, there might, like, the idea that there might be antiques in the next ones is so titillating.
All right. So the other book is Antiques Maul, spelled M-A-U-L, by Barbara Allen.
Gotta be that one. 100% that one, please.
After her impossible but adorable mother quits the local theater group, Brandy Bourne has a brilliant idea for keeping mother out of trouble. Open their own booth at the new antiques mall in town. But things turn grim when a body is found between the cigar store Indian and the chamber pot. The local law believes the normally good-natured Brad Pitbull The victim's dog mauled its owner to death, but Brandy and mother suspect the hound has been framed.
Hey, are they like allergic to not working in some sort of like minor racism, some kind of microaggression?
So, okay, that's the cozy mystery, which is option number one. Option number two, I'm not going to tell you the genre, but I think you'll figure it out pretty quickly.
Okay.
A Highlander for Christmas by Sandy Blair.
I would love to know where antiques work into this.
'Tis the season to be jolly, but Boston antiques dealer Claire McGregor isn't looking forward to a solo Christmas, or cocoa for one, or trimming the tree by herself. But company's coming. Claire is fooling around with an old puzzle box, and when it opens, a gorgeous Studley Laird appears. Thumbs down, Sir Cameron McLeod is centuries old. Thumbs up, he doesn't look it. And Cameron is tall, dark, and lusty. Very lusty.
Someone was watching fucking Hellraiser and just like, I don't like what came out of the box that time. What if I wrote my own?
And yet, somehow I feel like this will have more antiques than Tagged for Death.
I think so.
Okay, so we are approaching an hour and a half of yelling about a book no one has read, so.
Okay. I vote for Shopping Mall, by the way.
Okay.
Or Antiques Mall, whatever.
Antiques Mall. Let us know what book you would like us to read, or if you'd like us to stop reading books and get back to antiques.
Listen.
Email us directly at antiquesfreakspodcast@gmail.com.
Listen, and be gentle, shit's going on.
Or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/antiquesfreaks. And join our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends. We also have a Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks, where you can listen to deleted scenes for the low, low price of $1 a month.
Or, if you like to, you could leave us a review, even on iTunes, and if it talks about how much you hate us and we suck, that still helps us, so joke's on you, buddy.
Or you could suggest other antiques-related books for us to read, other cozy mysteries to read, or other antiques topics you'd like to see you talk about. Special shout out to our current patrons for paying our hosting fees and getting us ever closer to our goal of releasing bonus episodes. And thank you in particular for listening.
That's right, you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.